You know what I've been thinking lately is that we're getting to the part of the year where I'm actually probably going to buy a new video game. I can't remember the last time.
I bought four last week.
No. You probably bought them all used at GameStop, though. I'm talking about pre-ordering on Amazon a brand new video game and getting it the day it comes out. I don't really remember the last time I did that. It was probably last fall.
Portal 2?
When Batman comes out. Portal 2 actually didn't get right away. Maybe I did.
I could have sworn I remember you say you were pre-ordering that.
But that certainly would have been the last time, but I'm not even sure that I got that on day one.
I'm opposed to pre-ordering games in general.
Well, on Amazon, you're not paying until it actually ships. Yeah, it's not really pre-order. It's just letting you guys know I want this shit as soon as it comes out.
I did pre-order two games today, actually.
At GameStop?
And they are Xenoblade, which I pre-ordered just before it came out, and Inazuma 11, which is technically, quote, not out in the UK, but is anyway.
So did you pre-order on Amazon?
No, I pre-ordered it on a website called Zavvi.com.
Sounds legit.
No, that used to be Virgin Megastore. Zavvi? They sold it off.
But I got it for 10 GBP off.
Nice.
Yeah, that's kind of the going rate on the stores, though, for 30 quid.
It?
Yeah. They say it's 40 quid, and then you're getting it for 30, but really everything's 30. You know, everywhere will sell it for 30.
So what's funny is with shipping and the quote, reduced price, the amount I ended up paying for it in US dollars is $49.72.
Dude.
So literally,
that's not bad.
Yeah.
Literally less than I would have gotten for it if it actually came out in North America, because I would have had to pay tax.
I should do that, James. I'll get the details from you, because, I mean, I pre-ordered it symbolically on Amazon. I pre-ordered Monado.
I pre-ordered it literally because I had a ton of store credit from shipping things to Europe. A ton of PayPal credit.
I've been thinking I'm probably going to import Xenoblade. I mean, I got to do the hack my Wii or whatever shit is.
It's getting fantastic reviews.
It is. It's getting absurd reviews. I did the hack my Wii on Monday, the one where they email or you put the thing on your memory card and it shows up on your board. Mm-hmm. It's really, really easy. And
it sounds easier than when I did it.
It is stupidly easy. The only thing is that while it's installing, it goes black for a while.
and you just
feel terrified. You just like, oh God.
I'm glad you warned me, because now I won't freak out when it happens. Because it's like, I wouldn't care that much about breaking a Wii, except I've got so much Virtual Console and WiiWare on there that I will never get back if I break it by hacking.
But I did that, and then the reviews started coming out. Literally reviews that chastise Nintendo of America for not bringing the game over.
Yeah. Okay, here's my question, though. Do you think all these, like, exuberant European reviews, do you think they're just kind of doing it to brag? Because they know the American media and American gamers are watching European reviews for once?
I think they're incredulous more than anything else.
Before we go too far off the deep end, how are we going to do this with the, you know...
Oh, okay. Hello and welcome to Radio Free Nintendo, episode 255, already in progress. I'm your host, Jonathan Metz, and with me as always are James Jones, John Lindemann, and Greg Leahy. We were just talking about Xenoblade Chronicles, which was recently released in Europe to very promising reviews.
It's released today, right?
We are hours away from its official release as we record.
Greg is actually standing in line right now.
Greg, are you still iffy on whether you're going to pick this up?
Well, I said before that I was going to wait and see what the reviews had to say, and not just from a score point of view or a general favorability, but what they actually said about the content of the game, the philosophies, the priorities in it, you know, how they sort of comport with me. And what you read in the reviews, which have been very, very complimentary across the board, pretty much 9 as a minimum. Obviously, it's a relatively small spectrum of reviews because it's just the sort of European leaning outlets that are doing it right now. But they all have very good things to say about the battle system. It's similar to FF12, but it's got its own wrinkles, such as using the sword, the Monado, actually sort of like gives you these glimpses into the future in certain cases where like, so you will actually see an attack that the boss is queuing up, if you like. And so that gives you an idea of like, okay, what some of these special moves do I want to queue up sort of in anticipation of that to then, you know, effectively counter it and things. So I'm very encouraged by the battle system, by the exploration stuff, and just the overall quality. It sounds like the localization, despite the fact that it's, you know, not the usual NOA treatment, obviously, seems like they did a pretty good job. At least some people are a bit more iffy on the voice work than others.
You can play it with English subtitles and Japanese voices.
You could do that too, yeah. And again,
which sounds classy to me.
Yeah, the localization for the script, I think, is the most important thing, and it seems like they've got that right.
It wouldn't be a Monolith game if the English VA wasn't terrible. I mean,
that is true.
It's true, yeah. Xenosaga and Disaster and Baten Kaitos. Jeez.
Baten Kaitos. Oh, famously. To act against the Empire? It's unthinkable.
Yeah, what I really want from them is
that was in the trailer.
Is a kind of like crossover voiceover game where they can get all of the shitty voiceover from all of their different games into one game and just make it a shitty voiceover fest. It would be amazing.
Like the Smash Brothers of voice acting.
Smash Brothers of shitty voice acting.
In general, those things, I think I'll be picking it up sooner or later. But I am actually in the position of just having got a new Wii game already because my import copy of Rhythm Heaven showed up, which is certainly no substitute for Xenoblade. It's quite different. But
similar depth.
Unlike a lot of people, you know, I don't know how many times on comment sections of these reviews that I've read, it's like, cool, I'll dust off my Wii for that. You know, that's the trotted out line at this point. Well, that's not something I have to do, but I think I'll be giving it a go. It might be a bit of a struggle. It might take me eons to actually beat it or whatever, because it sounds like it's a very expansive game. But I'm on board, especially because a little sweetener, Club Nintendo Europe, if you register it, I think within something like its first 6 weeks on sale, you get to download the soundtrack Nintendo reward, which everyone has wonderful things to say about the soundtrack.
Or if you don't, you'll be able to download it off Rapid Share 2 days later.
Yeah, but it's nice. It's a nice little treat to have as a, you know, an official kind of thing.
Yeah, that's very cool, actually. I'm not going to knock it. All right. Well, Greg, this really works out perfectly because in the notes I had you going first for new business,
and we can't defy the notes ever.
And I had you talking about European game news, which has been recent, and Xenoblade among that. But we've also heard some other crazy stuff about a new version of the Wii hardware coming out in the
it's
UK
different.
This fall.
Yeah, it's a weird one. So obviously you've had Gamescom going on this week, and there's been a number of announcements coming out of various companies. So some of it, you know, sort of not necessarily that directly linked to what's going on at Gamescom itself, but it's just sort of tis the season kind of thing. That's one of those really interesting things. So they're basically discontinuing, it seems like, the current version of the Wii Adventure is going to get phased out over the rest of this year for this new bundle, which is a redesigned Wii, which has been sort of somewhat stripped down in that it doesn't have the GameCube ports on it anymore. So all that sort of backwards compatibility has been essentially stripped out. And then also I think like they're probably just not supplying a stand anymore because it's apparently meant to be displayed horizontally.
I think they cut that little corner off that it catches on the lip of the stand, and then they turned the logo sideways.
Yeah, exactly. And then they don't have to put that gray thing over the hardware like that. That's pretty much just seems like they're cutting a few corners for cost reasons, put a new bundle with Wii Sports and Wii Party as the two games with it, and that's going to be the SKU that's on sale over the holidays and all that over here
in Europe.
Yeah, that just for Europe. And it's funny because it seems to be something that people are looking at for the European market is sort of cutting production costs specifically for Europe, because there's this new PSP that's coming as well that's got Wi-Fi taken out just so they can have
that's really weird.
A budget version of that on sale. And that's just for Europe too.
But all the games come out online.
Yeah, that's really strange considering Sony wants to sell people games over PlayStation Network for PSP.
Well, you could still do it through your PS3.
Well, but you know what, though? I think that's Sony pretty much saying that we get it. Everybody just buys used games for PSP.
Yeah. But actually, what would be great is if it had neither Wi-Fi nor a UMD drive.
Yeah, the PSP no-go.
Yeah, exactly.
So what's interesting, though, is that going back to that Wii, unless, John, you want to talk about the PSP some more.
No. No, I'm quite all right.
That particular iteration of the Wii is a bit like if they had taken the DSi and not added anything to it. Mm-hmm. It just literally just said, we're going to take out the GBA slot and we're done.
Well, it makes sense to me. I mean, obviously, it's a cost-cutting measure for Nintendo. And it would make sense to me if they pass those savings, at least partially, onto the customer, which I think eventually they will. I mean, I think what Nintendo probably did was they looked at the Wii hardware and said, because of just the base cost of the components that are in this thing, especially since it's essentially two consoles in one, right? Mm-hmm. Because of that, it's going to be hard for us to ever get down to like a really crazy mass market price point. Like in the US, for instance, we're talking like $99. And what they might have done a manufacturing analysis and said, well, obviously the market will drive us to that price point sooner than later. We're getting fairly close anyway, but there's just no way for us to get the components down low enough that we could actually sell it for that. We'd be losing money at that point, which really defeats the purpose of selling this legacy console. So I think this is prep for that. I just don't understand why anyone would buy this for the price that you could have had the fully featured Wii. Like, I understand this might be appealing to some people, because you think, if you're buying a Wii 5 years after it launched, you don't care about GameCube support. Yeah. You really don't. Unless you're buying a replacement Wii.
At which point you're pissed.
Yeah. In that case, get a black one, you know. But I certainly wouldn't recommend to any of my friends or family that they go out and buy one of these if it does come out in America this year, which I think it will.
Yeah, I mean,
I know they're saying right now that it's not, but it will.
Yeah, we emailed our PR rep, and he's like, nope, this is a Europe-only thing. And
yeah,
we're like,
whatever. I don't know why. First off, they're making the hardware, so why not make it everywhere? I mean,
they're making the hardware in China. It's not like they're making it in Europe.
Yeah, and of course they want, I mean, they're doing this to cut costs on hardware, and they would want to cut costs on hardware everywhere. So
maybe the GameCube's still really important in the... Oh, it was never really important.
Hey-o!
PlanetGameCube.com.
Yeah, well, that was one thing that came out, but they also had their software schedule. It's a little earlier. Like, normally the software schedule for a quarter, you know, comes out when you're into that quarter at this point, but with Gamescom and all that, we're getting a bit of a head start. And so a couple of the things they did officially confirm now, we've had very strong indications before, but they're officially confirming Last Story and Pandora's Tower for Europe in 2012. They're committed to that now.
Motherfuckers.
Going on from what we talked about in recent episodes, the impact of the 3DS experience launching it the way they did, and obviously they've had to cut the price. We said that augurs in the direction of a later Wii U launch than perhaps otherwise would have been the case, or just merely intuits it. But I mean, to me, it could offer maybe some hope for America from the point of view that if their plans have changed because of that, they might find themselves in more need of spacing out some Wii games in 2012 than they previously thought.
Out of sheer necessity at that point.
Or they could do what they've done for previous generations, which is simply don't release anything.
Yeah, I mean, they have done that in the past.
I mean, the GameCube lineup in 2006 is...
I don't want to talk about
brutal.
It. I don't want to talk about it.
It's actually worse than the N64 in 2003.
Hey, I got Baten Kaito's Origins.
You got that after the Wii launch. I'm talking about before.
I still got it. Okay,
it was technically in 2006, but it was in December, wasn't it?
Yeah, well, other than the sort of the next year stuff, though, one thing I'm particularly excited about is that we're getting Gargoyle's Quest next week.
On the
virtual console. Obviously, it's been out in Japan for a while, so, you know,
that's a good game, not
terribly surprising, so looking forward to that. And then you've got a few things confirmed for the rest of the year, like Mario Land 2, and Metroid 2, and Bionic Commando over the Game Boy Color.
Mario 2 Land.
Bionic Commando Elite Forces is badass. And also, the big deal there is that's a Game Boy Color game, which we haven't had since Link's Awakening.
Yep.
Yeah, well, I think it goes back to they're trying to weed out the old games first.
Yeah, predominantly.
I've mentioned it on the show before, but the first time I ever met John Lindemann, we sat down and played Bionic Commando on Game Boy Color.
Indeed we did. I remember that.
That would have been E3 2001.
Yep.
Was it good for you?
Because the Game Boy Advance wasn't quite out yet. It came out like a couple of weeks after E3.
So it's been a surprisingly kind of newsworthy kind of few weeks and whatnot with the Wii, with all this Xenoblade stuff, and the confirmation of those games for next year as well is a nice touch. Interesting timing that they actually managed to sort of do that at the same time that Xenoblade was coming out. I think that's intentional from the point of view. Mm-hmm. It's probably going to get them a bit more coverage across the board, you know, try and get a sort of second spike on the kind of mind share.
Slot the release to Gamescom, basically.
But the good reviews help as well. It definitely seems like a lot of people are getting on board because of the reviews. If you look at it, it's kind of surged up a lot of the online retailers' charts that I look and check for.
Well, I've always thought Xenoblade looked really cool, but again, the cynical side of me wonders if this might be, let's say, sweet grapes. You know, like, we got them, you don't.
Saccharine grapes.
They taste so good.
Well, if that were the case, people wouldn't have universally shit on Disaster 2.
Yeah, I guess so. That's a very fair point.
I think it was probably some people that liked Disaster.
I love Disaster. I haven't even played it.
Disaster didn't exactly have the groundswell of yearning from across the pond.
With that, it was more the principle of the thing. Anybody actually wanting the game. They were just like,
hey. I wanted the game. Fuck you.
Well, James, you just modded your Wii, didn't you?
I know. I'll have to
So
go ahead.
What's stopping you, brother? Let's get some bears and tornadoes up in this podcast.
When I bought Xenoblade, I checked to see if they had it and Lost in Blue. They didn't have either. I was sad.
Well, Greg, I think we've established what you're going to be playing next week on the eShop, but why don't you tell us what you've got now on it?
Yeah, that's right. I've been playing a bit of Game & Watch Gallery. It's actually quite a latter-day kind of Game Boy game. It's from 97, I think it is. They went on to make quite a few of these.
They made three on the Game Boy Color, and I think they made one or two on the GBA?
Yeah. I'm not sure, but it's this is the first one still on the black and white system, and it collects four Game & Watch games, but presents two versions of them. So you've kind of got eight games, one being the sort of pretty much faithful version, and then another which has like the Mario characters in them and has some additional kind of gameplay refinements and additions that kind of make it a bit more substantive as a game. But I mean, basically, you're talking about high score challenges. So you've got what was it? Manhole, Fire, Oil Panic, and Octopus. Those are the four. And they all a question of you having the best score, and they get increasingly sort of crazy and difficult to handle, especially if you have it on the hard difficulty on the modern ones. They're really quite addictive in that way. But it's the perfect sort of thing for a portable virtual console. You know, I mean, this sort of game, there are some of these types of games on the Wii Virtual Console that are primarily about high scores and all that kind of stuff. And it's difficult to set aside the time to play those when you're in front of the telly, because you think, well, maybe I'd be better off playing Final Fantasy 3/6 or something if I've got some time to sit in front of the TV and play a virtual console game. But on 3DS, this is perfect. It's just like, you know, something that's always there. You just open it up, think, oh, you know, I've got a few minutes spare. I'll just play this, try and beat my score. It's absolutely perfect for that. And these games, you know, I think especially the modern versions, they have enough of a little twist on it to make it interesting in each case. And the presentation with the Mario characters is quite nice as well. Like, my favourite's got to be Fire, with like Mario and Luigi sort of going back and forth with this trampoline or whatever to bounce these Toads and Baby Yoshis and DK Juniors that are getting thrown out of this burning building. It's the basic premise of that is that all those little baby characters getting thrown out of the building, they descend at different rates. So you've just got to kind of keep track of what's going to hit the ground first and make sure you save them accordingly. But when it starts getting crazy and there's just tons of them getting hurled at you, you're just frantically tapping. It's really quite incredible when you can survive like a barrage like that. It feels great. And also, like Octopus, I like the modern twist on that, where you were trying to get treasure, avoiding the tentacles of the octopus, and then take it back to Peach in the boat. But what you can do if you're in a tight spot is throw the cash at the octopus to prevent it from killing you. Just things like that which make it a bit more sort of intricate. It's still simple stuff. It's still score challenges, but that for me gives it a bit more sort of lasting power.
A bit more game-ish.
Yeah, exactly. And so I think it's, you know, $3 in the States, £2.70 here, therefore with the 0.9 exchange rate essentially. So I think it's going to be over the long haul. You know, it's not something you're just going to, like some virtual console games, you know, you might pour a bunch of time in and then kind of lose interest. I think it's more of a long haul kind of thing. You know, any time you find yourself just wanting to dip into something on a brief basis for your 3DS, it's there and it's really fun.
Yeah, speaking of that, I'll just go next because that's a perfect segue into a game I was going to talk about again, which is Alpha Bounce. And that's, you know, a DSiWare game. I downloaded it day one on the eShop because I'd heard good things about it. And I mean, I talked about it a few weeks ago and, you know, I played it off and on, but then last weekend I had family in town. That's why I had to leave the show early. And the thing with having family or friends in town is, I mean, with friends, you might play games with them. With my family, not really. I mean, we were busy. We had a lot of stuff we wanted to do. We had a baby here, so my baby niece, and took forever to, you know, to go anywhere with her. So just the day just gets sucked up very quickly with all the things going on. And it was great. It was a great time, but it didn't leave me any time to play video games. And the only time I got to play anything was kind of just 5 minutes here, 5 minutes there. You know, I'm kind of hanging out in my room while they get dressed or whatever before we go out to eat. And so I ended up picking up Alpha Bounce and putting a lot more time into it than I had previously. And I've played a lot of it now. I guess my impressions of it aren't really much different than before, except that it certainly does get more challenging as you get deeper into it. I mean, this is the Arkanoid RPG, basically. And what I was concerned about is that, you know, as you sort of explore this grid map of the universe and you find new items that you can add on to your little ship that give you, you know, like you get a stronger ball that goes faster, that breaks more bricks, or you add a laser to it that you can use to sort of slowly chip away at bricks, and or you get an extension that makes the bar longer so it makes the game a little bit easier. You get all these things, and my concern was, well, you know, this sort of Arkanoid gameplay is not really going to change much over time, so this is just going to get easier and easier and easier. And it was already really easy because of all the ridiculous power-ups that there are in the game that just stack on top of each other. And what I found is that as you explore into the deeper regions of the universe, basically as you get farther into the game, you find that the stages seem to be very intelligently balanced over time. They seem to develop, maybe it's just the rate that the power-ups come up slows down, or you get less of the good ones and more of the ones that really are kind of annoying that don't actually help you. Maybe it's just that they throw in more kinds of bricks that are harder to deal with, that they regenerate, or they just take multiple hits, or they're, you know, they start throwing in more enemies that actually try to, like, shoot things at your ship that makes it actually very difficult to catch the ball before it hits the bottom of the screen because you're trying to dodge bullets at the same time. So it adds a lot of interesting twists. And then at the same time, you are finding better equipment and you are getting better at the game. And so it feels like it balances itself out a little bit more as you get deeper into it. And I kind of, from the first time I played it for a couple of hours, I kind of wrote it off as something that was neat and a cool idea, but maybe not executed all that well. You know, something that I might mess around with every now and then, but it's not really a game to be taken seriously. And now I think there's actually a lot more creative design that went into this and a lot more thought into how it's all put together than I originally expected. And again, the game is actually kind of gigantic. There's just like tons and tons of stuff, and you don't really get a sense that there's an ending to it. I mean, maybe there's an ending if you do certain things, but it's more of just this giant buffet of Arkanoid levels that, I mean, just like hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of them, and they're all different to some extent. And the game's just really fun to play. So it is very bite-sized. You know, you can play it for 3 minutes and be done with the level and then close the 3DS or your DSi and put it away and come back the next day. So it's really kind of perfect for that. And I think I'm starting to feel like this is a game that I actually will sort of chip away at for a long time to come. So I would definitely recommend it, even more than the last time. And the only other thing I've had any time to play, and this actually, This should tell you exactly how much time I've had to play video games the past week, because I'm still not finished with Insanely Twisted Shadow Planet, and I've actually played it like 3 or 4 distinct occasions. And this is a game that everybody's complaining that it's too short, that it's like 4 hours long, and I'm still not. I think I'm like 75% through it, so... But I loved it last week, and I still love it. In fact, I love it more now, because you get deeper in the game, and it actually becomes more interesting. They give you new tools and new challenges and new enemies to deal with that are actually more fun to get by than the ones in the beginning were. And the level design becomes a lot more intricate, because when you start out, you're in this natural-looking cave, and it's a lot of sort of just corridors, you know, and then you go around a curve, but they're fairly wide, and there's a few enemies in there. You get deeper in the game, and you go through some pretty crazy environments, some of them that affect the way your ship moves. Either there's some kind of gusts of wind that make it hard to get by in your little UFO, or you go underwater, and you control a little bit more sluggishly there. You go into an ice area where you have to think about there's all these lasers in this level that you're trying to redirect them through the caverns to get to a certain thing. And so you have to start thinking about how the laser is going to bounce off all these different walls, which is very similar to some stuff that's in Pixel Junk Shooter 1 and 2. And then I got into this amazing mechanical region of the planet, which involves some pretty crazy, there's a lot of gears and like the world's flipping around me, so it's kind of reorienting itself a lot, and very intricate sort of Rube Goldberg type puzzles that you're trying to get through. And it was completely different than anything I'd seen before, and I thought it was excellent. So this game continues to deliver, and I continue to be a pretty huge fan of Insanely Twisted Shadow Planet. And for me, it's not too short, because obviously it's taken me a while to get through it, because I can't really focus on it very much. But I do love it. Every time I play it, I just think, man, this is so good. All right, John, how about you?
Let's see. For PS3, I am playing the Resistance 3 beta, the multiplayer beta. Mm. And I'm a big fan of the series. I know some people aren't really too big of a fan of it, but I really liked the first game, because the online was really fast-paced. It was just a lot of fun. The second one, single player, was okay, not really as good as the first. They kind of tried some different things. They tried to give... I think one of the big problems, it made me think about kind of like first-person shooter franchises as a whole. It's like if you look at the first-person shooter franchises that are popular, they typically hinge, or even a lot of games, even not even, you know, FPSs, but I was thinking like Uncharted, right? A game like that, they often hinge on one particular character. They center around one character. And I think one of the kind of flaws with like R3 and, you know, all the rest of the games in the series is that they've never really had one character. They've tried to focus on one character, but there is no iconic character for that series for people to latch onto. So I think that's kind of why it's always been received in sort of a lukewarm fashion.
Well, it hasn't really hurt Modern Warfare.
Well, Modern Warfare does feature some of the same characters, though.
Yeah,
you don't play as a single character.
No, but the same characters show up in the various Modern Warfare titles.
Yeah.
I mean, there's no reason why Soap McTavish should be in all of these places, but he is.
Yeah, but the fact that you even know who Soap McTavish is...
He should be a generic... I mean...
He has the most amazing name. Come on.
Yes.
That's why you remember it.
Better than Master Chief? Johnny, come on. Master Chief. He's a master...
Bad.
And a chief. It's amazing. It's brilliant.
So bad.
You know? But yeah, there's like a lot of series kind of hinge on these icons that people kind of, you know, latch onto. And I feel like this series has never really had it. But that said, the beta, I've been underwhelmed by it. It's just, it feels a lot like, because the big selling point was that they said, well, it mixed kind of the first game, which was really like a lot of hectic action, with the second game, which kind of had bigger environments. And I think you had the largest battles in that, like you had squads, like there could be 60 people on the field at any one time. So 30 on 30, I guess, and broken up into like squads of 10 or whatever. It was crazy. They just tried to cram too much into the second game. But with this one, they said their selling point was that it was kind of a mix of the two. And while that's the case, it's kind of more like the second one. It's really sort of kind of a little bit slower paced and stuff like that. And they did some stuff like, you know, one of the big things from the first game was that they had like a gun wheel, so you could like hold down, you know, the left stick or something and bring up the gun wheel, and then you could pick your gun. And they took that out of the second game, and now it's back in. So kind of, there's a lot of things like that, but it's almost, it's interesting because I think it's probably the first game where I played it ahead of time and I'm kind of like, yeah, don't really know if I actually want to get this at launch because I have it pre-ordered, which is why I got the key to even get into this, right? Because Amazon was, you know, they handed out the keys.
So then you can cancel your pre-order now that you have
the key. Exactly it. That's the whole thing. Like, you would think that, wow, yeah, that's, it's awesome. Like, you know, I get the key ahead of time, so I have the game pre-ordered. But now I'm like, I've actually played the game and I'm kind of like, this versus Halo Reach, I'm sort of like...
You're wobbling.
Yeah, like, exactly. Like, it's probably the worst thing they could have done because now I'm just like, I could probably wait to buy this. Like, I don't really need it at launch date, especially when there's really no good pre-order incentives to buy it, so...
Well, Insomniac is famous for their creative weapon designs and,
yep.
You know, I think that doesn't impact my enjoyment of Ratchet and Clank as much as it does some people. I think it's mostly just silly stuff, but I haven't played Resistance, and I've heard that they have some of the same... appeal in terms of, you know, it's a like a real first person shooter but with crazy ass weapons. And I wonder, you know, in a world where we now actually have Bulletstorm, which I think does crazy first person shooter weapons better than anything I've ever played, I wonder how Insomniac's going to compete with that.
Yeah, I mean, the only thing I have in the beta, they have two game modes. They have Team Deathmatch and Chain Reaction, which is pretty much capture these 5 points and then you win. And so it's nothing really too outside the box in terms of like the guns and all that kind of stuff. The games have always had a lot of guns with the big thing is you always have some sort of wacky secondary fire. For example, with the Bullseye, that particular gun, you can shoot like a tag dart at somebody. And then as they're running away from you, because they're tagged, if you shoot, it'll follow them like heat-seeking bullets. So there's a lot of stuff like that. It's not really too outside the box. I mean, like compared to like if you've never played those games, it might be. But if you've played the other games in the series, then it's kind of expected.
Well, at least they have the one that shoots the disco ball and makes all the other guys start dancing.
Actual Ratchet and Clank weapon.
Yes.
Well, wouldn't that be fun though if they actually started mixing Ratchet and Clank weapons, or like here's the Resistance 3 version of it. Like here's what this would look like if you put it into a quasi-realistic setting. Yeah. You know, but it still does essentially the same thing. It still turns them into a sheep.
Instead, it's like a horrible neurotoxin where they go into really, you know, disgusting, revolting convulsions and spasms and all that. But you still have the disco ball.
Yeah, exactly.
So, but yeah, you can definitely see the influence from those games where, like, you know, things are kind of over the top in terms of the guns that you use. Like, definitely, like, it's very obvious compared to other first-person shooters that they specifically want something really unique about each gun to have, like, some sort of secondary.
Well, I guess they've got the whole alternate history sci-fi stuff. I mean, you may as well use it to have wacky weapons, you know, the fact you've got this whole alien technology thing. It's kind of like what we talked about with the Perfect Dark retroactive. You know, the benefit of having this silly storyline, at least, was you could have, and obviously, you know, Resistance is nowhere near that silly, from what I understand.
Yep.
But
yeah, like there's the one gun called the Auger, where like I think you can shoot through walls with it, which is a pain in the ass when you're actually playing other people because you'll be trying to like hide from them and they just shoot through the wall and kill you, but. But you can also, like, at the same time, you can bring up a shield around you kind of thing. So there's a lot of that. But apparently, from the kind of impressions that I've read online, the single player is amazing. I remember there's one particular one that I read where the guy was like, yep, you know, I was the only one in the office. Like, no one here really likes FPS games. So I was the only one in the office that would be willing to look at it. But its single player is amazing. So I don't really know what to make of it. I don't know. The pre-order, I will say right now, is tenuous.
He's a changed man.
I am a changed man. It's the, you know, things in this economy, you know?
Yeah, the economy only just got dodgy. It hasn't been that way for like 3 years now.
Well, to be fair.
God, the boom times of 2008. Well, he was, you know.
When he cancels the sale, he will only make it worse. It is his patriotic duty to buy this game.
Money to burn back in those days, my friends. Those days are long gone, long gone.
Back when John was lighting cigars with sealed copies of Mass Effect.
Tonight, I think I'll throw on the fire Tom Clancy's Rainbow Six Vegas 2. Throw it on there.
Do you own that, really?
I do own that, Johnny. It's one of... I don't even call it a hall of shame at this point. It's not even a Hall of Shame because it's more like a wing of shame.
Well, I was going to say, this whole understate the size of it?
Yep. Yeah, I mean, I believe it's Tom Clancy, like, longest title ever. Tom Clancy's Rainbow Six Vegas 2. I don't even think I have put that game into my Xbox 360, but I own it, and damn it, I'm proud of it.
Maybe one day we'll be hearing more about that one.
No, we won't.
At the rate you're going, I think you will actually play most of the games you've bought.
Mm-hmm.
All right, James Jones, I need you to please wrap up new business.
Right, so played more Borderlands. I'm going to defend my comments, which were attacked in the forums, that the sniper rifle is worthless. I'm going to stand by that statement because oftentimes it's just not useful.
Maybe the one you have is worthless, but there are ones that are great.
It's a tactical issue more than anything. It doesn't feel like what a sniper should be doing. A lot of times it's still pretty close to the action, and they're still hitting you with spray and pray weapons. I've only found a handful of times where I'm really far back and doing damage, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
And they're not still hitting me. But be that as it may, what I found about the game is that, and I touched on this last week, but it became much more apparent when these other sections of the game world became accessible and they started giving you the car more, is that, I mean, I understand it's supposed to be like a wasteland, but it's a bit too much of a wasteland. There's the density of content is very low. And there was a mission where basically all you had to do was go from one end of the planet to the other. Didn't have to fight anybody. Just go there, look at something, and then go back.
A lot of teleporting and loading.
Yes.
Because when you teleport, you get a load screen.
A lot of loading.
It's a big reason why I played most of Borderlands with my headphones on, listening to podcasts. Because there's enough downtime. And when the game cranks up, you know, you might pause it or you might focus less on what you're listening to. But there's plenty of downtime in that game where I was glad that I had something to... It's kind of like a long road trip where I'm kind of tired of this music. Let's turn on NPR, even though it's boring. You know,
sounds pretty funny. I'm sure that's what they were shooting for. Okay, guys, in this part of the game, the vibe we want here is road trip. So
look, they got tote bags for that game. That's all I'm gonna say.
And also, there's not much music to speak of in Borderlands.
No,
so
and it's pretty.
You're not missing anything by
it's pretty
listening.
Humdrum if you actually do have it.
Yeah.
What to me, it just feels like there's a certain level of action that gets diminished when the game gets into the drive mode. But I just feel like it would be better if there was something going on besides occasionally being attacked by monsters you can then just proceed to run over.
Hmm.
But soldier on, played a boss battle where you're supposed to fight him in the car and just stayed outside of where the car could get to and shot him thousands of times until he died. I don't know. So there are elements of the game I'm enjoying, but I just wish I didn't have to work so hard to get to them.
Hmm.
Which kind of makes the other game I just started playing today, Enslaved Journey to the West, seem kind of the opposite because there's no padding in this game.
No.
I started an hour and a half before we began recording, and I'm on chapter 3.
Yeah. Yep. Yep.
I think there's, what, like 7?
They get longer. Okay. Some of the later ones are
longer. I don't even remember where chapter 1 was. I was just in chapter 2 all of a sudden. I'm like, okay. But, it's, you know, I know this is Ninja Theory and not Team Ninja, but that's a Ninja Gaiden game. It does. It feels like one, just not nearly as difficult. It feels like a mix of Ninja Gaiden and
there's not nearly as much platforming in Enslaved.
No, well, there is, but it's like Prince of Persia platforming.
Yeah, or Uncharted.
Yeah, but I mean, it's like you press jump and it contextually decides that he's going to jump sideways and at a weird angle and grab this thing over here.
Right, like you can't fall down. Yeah,
like you literally can't jump into abysses. The game will not let you.
Right.
I tried because I was like, maybe I should jump over there. I'm hitting the button and he just stands there staring at this gaping maw I'm trying to jump over. I'm like, okay, he's not going to let me go that way. Fine, I'll go the other way. Obviously, I only played it for an hour and a half, but the combat's not great, but oh my god, that game is pretty.
Yeah, and the combat gets better, too, I think you'll find.
Okay, it feels very simple right now.
Yeah, he gets a lot more abilities later on.
Hit with one button, hit with another button, and then try not to get hit in the face. That's basically what combat is at the moment. But I am more just Like, at this point, I'm not even all that interested in getting through the gameplay. I just kind of want to see what they're going to show me at the next moment.
Mm-hmm.
What I find particularly striking is the female character who they just named, and they've only said her name once, so I can't remember what it is. But the person who has done the enslaving, I actually find that she might have one of the best human faces I've seen in a game possibly ever. Like, it looks like a face.
Yeah.
It's not like got this weird disjointed dead behind the eyes look going on. The skin has actual scratches on it from previous scrapes with things. Like, there's physical imperfections that are present. It moves properly.
And she's really well acted, too. And since we brought up Rotpota early in the show, or maybe that was even before we started recording, but, I mean, Andy Serkis plays the main character, Monkey. I think his, I mean, just the physical performance of Monkey, because it is a very physical character, and he's always moving, and he kind of has this strange body language to him, is super impressive. And I haven't seen Rise of the Planet of the Apes yet, but I'm really excited to, partly because I played Enslaved. And yeah, I mean, obviously he's great as Gollum in Lord of the Rings, but that's a character who that's more a vocal character than a physical character. He doesn't move around that much in those movies. Whereas, Monkey is a very athletic, really cool character, actually. I mean, he seems a little bit annoying at first when he starts talking to the girl, but over time, I think you'll learn to sympathize with him more.
How about you take this thing off so I can break your neck?
It's worth mentioning Andy Serkis also was responsible for the sort of performance capture-y kind of stuff in King Kong as well. He's getting typecast. Basically,
yeah, he's always a digital monkey.
I'm starting to get worried that when they do the Hobbit, like, Gollum's gonna be hairier, maybe. It's just
Well, he's not an actual monkey in Enslaved. He's a dude named Monkey, which is primarily done to match up with the myth, the Journey to the West.
Certain elements of his attire match the classical depiction of the character Monkey, including they put this belt on him that kind of looks like a tail when he's moving.
Exactly.
But what I found about the game, besides looking really good, is, like you said, it's actually, with the exception of Monkey's VA, which is kind of grunty, it just sounds really nice. Like, they clearly put a lot of work into the presentation on this game, and I'm not sure that the gameplay has quite lived up there, but I think it's a really great game for a guy who just got a much larger HDTV.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Like, I was trying to make dinner, and it became a distraction. Like, the water was boiling for a good 2 minutes before I did anything with it.
I mean, that opening scene where you're on the outside of the sort of aircraft thing.
Yeah.
You're climbing around on the outside and you're thinking, this is really impressive. And then you start flying over New York City.
Yes.
And it is ridiculous looking.
And shit's blowing up.
One of the coolest scenes I've ever seen in any video game.
I mean, when it breaks the clouds, because he impacts, I won't say what he impacts because that's kind of a spoiler, but he impacts something as it's passing through the cloud layer, and all of a sudden you realize you're over New York, and then the camera shoots back to show you the city as a whole. It's very cinematic.
Yeah.
Now, what that has meant, though, is in the game's attempt to be cinematic, we've sort of inherited next-gen Resident Evil cameras with the changing perspective camera as you go into different places.
It's very much like God of War. Which you probably haven't played recently, but I mean, God of War 3 uses exactly the same system.
I hate that system. I just hate when you go into a room and suddenly up turns left. Like that.
Yeah, it can be pretty disorienting.
That should never happen in any year after 2000.
Yeah, I mean, that's partly, though, why the presentation's so good.
I understand that, but you can move the camera around in that game. It's not like it's fixed. It's not like it's Resident Evil where they only decorated two walls. You can turn the camera to look in any direction, and it looks pretty in all of them.
Yeah, I mean, I think it occasionally can be frustrating from a gameplay perspective, but most of the time, it's really not a big deal. I mean, it might annoy you, but it's not really going to change how you play the game much.
It was only a problem in the scene where you're going through a minefield and in a fight where it kept changing back and forth as I was getting bounced between the two camera spots.
and the mines kind of go away after a while. You start doing different things. So
yeah, those fucking bite me.
They're super annoying at one point. It kind of hits a peak of like, oh my god, if this is what the rest of the game's like, I'm going to stop playing it. And then you get over the hump and it's like, oh, okay. Wait until has he jumped on the cloud yet?
No.
That is very interesting stuff. It doesn't control great, but it feels really good. And it's really fun to do. And it's like, it just comes out of nowhere. The game starts to play completely differently when he pulls out the cloud. It's really weird. It's like, all of a sudden, dude has like a hoverboard.
Yeah, I think, and I sort of alluded to this already, I think it feels like they put a whole lot of effort into the presentation. And then they're like, you got to make some gameplay for this too. I mean, considering it was their first effort as a company.
No, it wasn't.
It wasn't? It was their first one.
Heavenly Sword.
Oh, you're right, yeah.
Andy Serkis is also in.
He's in Heavenly Sword?
Yeah, he plays the villain, I think. And then
yeah.
He's you know, I mean, they're making the new Devil May Cry, and I yep. think that's I don't like the character design that they showed. I'm going to bet that will change somewhat to be less awful.
It looks like one of the game's producers. I'm not kidding. It really yeah, does.
That character designs that they showed is really bad. We'll probably see more of it at TGS. But I think that game is otherwise, and that design might have even come from Capcom. But I think the game's otherwise in really good hands. Based on Enslaved, I think they're a bold choice, but I think they're a good choice to make a Devil May Cry game.
I think they just need somebody as a publisher who cares about making sure the game is as polished as it can be.
Yeah.
And I think that's kind of what they were lacking with this game.
I think for me, Devil May Cry is a series that I like in principle, but after playing 4, I think that game could stand to be less Japanese.
Oh, you think the game is bad. The cartoon is way worse.
Cartoon?
There is a Devil May Cry cartoon, yes.
Oh. Okay.
It is the worst thing I've ever seen. And yet watched all of it because it was so funny.
I'm sure there's a lot of, huh?
There's a lot of him walking into a room and going, hey, you, I'm going to shoot you in the face. And then he pulls out a giant gun and shoots it in the face. And that is narrative. And then he walks out.
Dante's a terrible character. He is a terrible character. He really is.
It is amazing.
Okay, folks, thanks for listening to New Business. We're going to take a break. And when we come back, we're going to talk about the Super Nintendo. And we're back. You know, this week, instead of doing listener mail, I thought we would mix it up a little bit for the debut of season 3, and which I haven't explained at all.
I killed listener mail last week is the problem.
Yeah, James kind of put the nail in the coffin of listener mail with that Mario Kart 7 essay that he wrote and recited. So anyway, it's been 20 years since Super Nintendo came out in North America, and we did talk about the Japanese 20th anniversary on the RFN live telethon for Child's Play back in December of last year. But since it is now the 20th anniversary for America, I thought we would revisit this this week on the show and talk a little bit more about Super Nintendo. I mean, part of it is that we were sort of time constrained on the live show, and not all four of us were on for that particular hour. It was difficult to get all four of us on at the same time that day because of scheduling. So, you know, I thought, hey, Super Nintendo is a big topic, plenty of room to go back to it. So it also coincides, funny enough, with the SNES 20, which is a feature that's ongoing up at the website. It's actually mostly done by the time you hear this. I think it's probably just finally wrapping up. So if you listen to the show right away, we might be about to spoil the last one or two games, but not by a large margin. So just to go over that really quickly, I figured this is a great launching point for us to talk about some of the best games of Super Nintendo, whether they're on this list or not. So the official NWR list, which we essentially voted on, we all kind of sent in our top 20 lists, and Neil sort of put them all together, and it wasn't completely numeric. There was a sort of a diplomacy portion of the process in which we sort of tried to build consensus to make sure that the list was okay with everyone, more or less. So a few things got left out, some of my favorite niche games, but maybe we'll get into that. So the official list of NWR, which you can, by the way, we have complete articles, complete write-ups with pictures and screenshots and everything on each one of these games. So if you hear about one of these that you feel nostalgic about, or you just want to learn more about it, maybe you're not familiar with it, go to the site and read. You can read a lot more about it there and get more information. So the full list is F-Zero, ActRaiser, Super Castlevania IV, Zelda A Link to the Past, Contra 3, Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles 4 Turtles in Time, Super Mario Kart, Street Fighter 2 Turbo, Star Fox, Secret of Mana, Mega Man X, Super Metroid, Final Fantasy 3/6, Donkey Kong Country 1 and 2, cheat, combined both games
that was
into
diplomacy.
One slot. Yeah, I guess so. Super Mario All-Stars plus World, that is a real cheat. That's like 6 games
in
a slot. But okay, sure.
It was on one cartridge.
Yeah, I don't object to All-Stars. I object to adding World to it. I know there was a cartridge with All-Stars and World, but those are two completely separate games. Earthbound, Chrono Trigger, Yoshi's Island, Super Mario RPG, and Kirby Superstar. That's a hell of a list. I mean, it's certainly not exactly the one that I threw in there, but you really can't argue with that list. You might argue with one game on it, but the list overall is pretty damn solid. So I kind of wanted to use the list as a launch point for us to talk about awesome Super Nintendo games. I mean, back in the live show in December, we mainly talked about the system itself as kind of a concept, you know, as its place in history and its changing over time and, you know, why it was released, when it was released, and why it's important today. So we've talked about it in a general sense. So I figured now that we've got a little more time to stretch this out, we can actually talk about the games, which is what's going on at the site anyway. So let's start with games on the list. Which ones of these on the list do you guys feel really passionately about?
Well, obviously Super Metroid we've dealt with in the past. There's no doubt of the esteem that we hold that one in. And of course, it would be nice to reference at this point just briefly Metroid's 25th birthday, which came up this month because it originally came out in 1986 August in Japan for the Famicom Disk System. Obviously Nintendo aren't really recognizing that right now. You know, I guess they did Mario last year, doing Zelda this year. Maybe they'll, as it has generally been more popular in America, they'll do something next year, because that is actually the 25th in America. It came out in 87. So I hope they do, but I just wanted them to kind of mention that. Obviously we've done a lot of Metroid specific shows before, so I don't think there's much that we can really do of use to commemorate it.
No, but one thing I do want to say about Super Metroid before we move to the next game is that it says a lot, and this is more true now than it was when we did the whole episode about it. 15, 16, 17 years after that game was released, Super Metroid, there are still games being made now that are direct tributes to it. In fact, it's pretty much its own genre. Yeah. So I think that alone tells you how important that game is and how much of an impression it made on an entire generation of gamers.
Yeah, I mean, it created a genre that is named after a game that actually aped it.
Yes, you know? Exactly.
Metroidvania, like, that's how influential it is.
Yeah, well put. Okay, you know, I think Super Mario Kart's really interesting because you guys and a lot of our listeners will have much stronger feelings about this game than I do. I played it at, like, friends' houses. I might have rented it once. I liked it, but that's about the extent of
it. See, that's where I'm at.
That series didn't hit big for me until the N64, at least.
Yeah, I'm in the same boat, Johnny.
No, actually I am as well. So that makes it a grand slam of Super Mario Kart of indifference, relatively speaking. I mean, for me, I didn't really play much until 64. Although I didn't even own 64, I just played other people's copies of it.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
So I didn't own a Mario Kart until GBA.
I didn't own one until the DS. I mean, that series just never did it for me.
Yeah, the first one I owned was on GameCube.
Kart racing is not my forte.
But I would say I have gone back to it on Virtual Console. And obviously haven't got a lot of two-player or that kind of thing, and that was a huge part of what made that game such a favourite, you know, that it is on that list, because a lot of our staff do have very fond memories of playing it with their friends. But, you know, I would say that even now, I think it holds up playing it as a single-player game. I mean, it's certainly a bit different from the ones that have followed in terms of the kinds of items you have, the coins, which are generally haven't reappeared very much. They reappeared in Super Circuit, and they're going to reappear in Mario Kart 7. But I like that idea of kind of, you know, introducing routes that you might take that aren't just based on the racing line and all that kind of thing. It's a risk reward and a sort of rivalry of like getting to them first. And like, so I have no doubt it's a very good game. If I'd had it at the time, I think I would have enjoyed it and got a lot of use out of it. I think the problem was, for me, being an import gamer at that time, it just, I'd had F-Zero, I absolutely loved that. I just don't know whether I felt the desperate need for another racing game on the system, even though it was, of course, very, very different and offers, you know, the whole other slant on the genre.
Yeah, if I recall correctly, I think I actually, I do own Mario Kart, but I think I bought it long after the fact, after it had become like a
big deal.
Like, I think was it Player's Choice title on the Super Nintendo?
Yeah.
Yeah, probably.
I think so. Yeah, like, I bought it, like, long afterwards. So it never really caught on for me.
See, I come from sort of Greg's perspective in that I had played a lot of F-Zero and really loved... I mean, F-Zero was a launch game in America, and I loved that game. I didn't own it, but my friends own it, and I borrowed it from them extensively. I might as well have owned it. Hmm. And so when I saw Mario Kart, to me, it just seemed like the same... I mean, it looks similar in that the technology is the same. It's still Mode 7. So I felt like, well, this has kind of been done before, and this is just way slower. And the things that make Super Mario Kart unique and innovative compared to F-Zero, I didn't really appreciate at the time. And in fact, even after I played it, you know, I liked the game, but it didn't really seem like that big of a deal. And Mario Kart, again, is a game that... I think I only really appreciate how important that game is now because it basically created a genre that's still very popular and that a lot of people are still trying to nail, and a lot of developers are still trying to make games in that genre and failing. They just don't understand it even now.
Mm-hmm. I think there's a certain element of we can make an easy license game that is part of the reason why that game, that genre is so riffed, essentially, why people...
Yeah, but there's also, I mean, the commercial motive. I mean, America, unlike Super Metroid, has become such a commercial juggernaut, there's always going to be some people that think, yeah, well, we could make a game like that, maybe we can get a bit of that pie. So I think that will frequently intersect with the license.
Yeah, I'm not sure it's so much an issue of the quality of the gameplay the series offers as it is the ability to easily ape it and hopefully make a lot of money.
Well, I mean, you say license and you're dismissive about it, but you know, there's amazing Mario Kart type games that wouldn't exist without Mario Kart. You've got stuff like Diddy Kong Racing, and you know, last year there was the Bizarre Creations game.
Mod Nation Races?
Mod Nation is another one.
Yep.
But I was talking about Blur.
Oh, of course, yeah.
Konami Crazy Racers, wasn't it?
Actually, that's a very good game. Very good Game Boy Advance game.
The preponderance of games in that genre are what I'm describing now.
Yeah. But regardless, it obviously was a big influential game. That's all I'm saying. F-Zero, unfortunately, I don't think has been as influential. I mean, there are...
Hey, it made Tube Sliders.
Well, it made Wipeout, obviously.
Yeah, Wipeout kind of ended up being a really big deal, I think, especially over here. You know, it was developed over here. The racing genre is very big in the UK, whether it's, you know, a sort of simulation type or it's something based on Formula One or, you know, something a bit more fanciful or sci-fi like Wipeout. So it kind of laid the groundwork for something that went on to be really popular. I don't think F-Zero itself has ever really capitalized on that in European markets, because really until the Wii, you know, even through the Super Nintendo, Nintendo consoles haven't been that popular until, you know, the last 5 years.
And then they never made an F-Zero for Wii.
Yeah,
and they're not going to, let me tell you. It's no. That ship has sailed. It's sad. No.
It's, yeah, that is sad, but yeah, I guess our hopes for that switch to 3DS.
Yeah, I think 3DS is a lot more likely.
Tube Sliders 3D, or Tube 3D Sliders.
You're so obsessed, James. You're so obsessed with Tube Sliders. You know, Star Fox, I think, deserves a mention here while we're on the list, because, you know, Star Fox 64 3D just came out in Japan. It's about to come out in the West. And personally, this is another case where I played the Super Nintendo one. I thought it was really cool. I didn't think it was that much fun. I thought it was too hard, and I thought it was a cool technology thing. I love looking at it.
Craig laughs at your pussy gaming skills.
that is a hard game. He is not kidding.
And also, the Super Nintendo D-pad, not terribly well-suited for the kind of game that Star Fox is.
I like the mushy D-pad. It really makes it feel like I have no control whatsoever.
It's just that game needs analog control, and the gameplay did not click with me until I had analog control for it. So, for me, the 64 game, I mean, the Star Fox 64 is so different.
Well, for me, Star Fox is a good sort of example of a lot of things that happened in the era with the whole, you know, especially a lot of Nintendo's first party stuff. They tried to have something about it that was maybe a technical breakthrough, or you know, something that was specific to Super Nintendo. You know, it was a volley fired across the bow of Sega in the console war and all that kind of stuff. But at the same time, it was a good game. I particularly like the soundtrack. It's absolutely outstanding in Star Fox. I still think he's got the best soundtrack of any of the Star Fox games, in my opinion. But in terms of it versus 64, it's a lot harder. I mean, it's much harder, and it's not as accessible. But that was the thing. But for me, you know, that game, the original Star Fox, ended up lasting me ages, because it took me quite a while just to beat the first route.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it is the proto Sin and Punishment.
Yeah, it played like more of an arcade game.
That first route feels really challenging, really epic. Or, you know, there's so many moments I remember vividly, like, you know, when you descend onto Venom and you get all the columns coming at you and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just, it's so memorable when you're not used to polygonal graphics, even though obviously now it looks, you know, pretty ropey and juddery, and it's in a little letterbox and, you know, all this kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, rate's horrible.
But then the next, you've got another two routes that are completely different. The content, there's really very little overlap between them at all. Yeah, so it's not just a difficulty switch. It's sort of hidden in this cosmetic thing of different routes. There are different levels, different bosses, and they get incredibly hard. I mean, the third route is unbelievably difficult. So I can understand a lot of people may not have seen the entirety of the original Star Fox.
Well, I just realized that there's probably an entire generation of people who tried out Sin and Punishment on Wii, the first and the second game, both on Wii, since it was because of Virtual Console, and have never played Star Fox because it's not easy to emulate, which is really sad, because, I mean, it is absolutely the basis for Sin and Punishment. So if you do like Sin and Punishment, either one of them, you really, I mean, it's a pain. Maybe you're going to have to go back and find a Super Nintendo, maybe, like a physical Super Nintendo and a copy of the game. But I think it'll be worth your while, because if you're way into Sin and Punishment, you really need to play Star Fox, the original.
Yeah.
Not necessarily the 64
one. And it's still not as crazy as that by any means.
No, it's much.
The hardware couldn't have handled anything that mad, and you haven't got separate controls for movement and shooting. So it's not as overwhelming as that. It's just tough relative to, you know, what you can do.
Yep.
But I would say, I mean, it's a great candidate for 3D Classics re-release. Certainly much better than Urban Champion, I think we can agree on that.
I disagree.
So I hope people will get a chance to experience it for the first time. You know, if Star Fox 64 3D re-release does sort of sets the groundwork, then perhaps they could sort of move up to Star Fox and the Super Nintendo, because difficulty-wise, that's kind of the way it is. Maybe you'd be better off playing 64 first.
I agree.
That's the thing. When I played 64,
look at the story.
When I played 64, like I did the first route, you know, the easiest one, in like a day, and I was appalled, frankly. What is this bullshit? But, you know, I certainly learned to appreciate Star Fox 64 a lot more over like the score elements.
Oh yeah, if you want to get the medals on expert, it's going to take a while.
Yeah, exactly.
The hidden paths of that game are what really sets it apart for me.
Yeah, the train level with the gates, and you know, there's loads of...
You need to know to veer into that waterfall, even though it looks solid.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, and go through the three rings as well, you know, first as well. I mean, Star Fox 64 is wonderful as well. So for me, I really couldn't pick a favorite amongst the two. I mean, I think Star Fox 64 is, in many ways, the superior game. You know, on a technical level.
Oh, no question.
The controls level and all that. But the original Star Fox has two things that I value a lot in a game: soundtrack and challenge. So it almost kind of levels it out. So I really couldn't pick between them.
Well, just looking at the other list, I'm kind of looking over it. And we've done retroactives on at least three of these games. So actually, yeah, at least three. And then we did Mother 3, which is very, very similar to Earthbound. And, you know, Chrono Trigger, we've obviously spent a lot of time talking about it. So.
John has given us a literal play-by-play of every scene in the
game. Thousands of hours.
A couple of the more interesting games on here that certainly I would not have put on are Turtles in Time, which is a game that is beloved by people, by a lot of people. And
yeah. It's just another brawler. I don't get it.
I look at it the same way. It's like, it was a high-quality generic brawler.
But there were a lot of high-quality brawlers in arcades at the time.
Yeah, like it was a big genre at the time.
That one had the right license, I guess, is why it's memorable. But, I mean, to me, it's no different than any of its, you know...
Well, yeah, the license is big, and, you know, also the actual multiplayer, I think, is an issue because, yeah, Final Fight, there was a lot, that was an early game. There was a lot made of that being a conversion, you know, the sort of a putting down the marker of what Super Nintendo was capable of. But it didn't have the multiplayer, you know, in that first release. So there were obviously brawlers that came later, like Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles that did. But I think that was one of the first ones, you know, with the sort of perfect storm of the license and the multiplayer. And all that. I mean, Turtles was. It might be difficult for some of our listeners to kind of imagine, but Turtles was massive at the time.
Oh, yeah.
It was a big so deal. Huge.
I will admit to having Turtles bedspread at that point.
Those were common. Yeah, I knew people who had those. Yeah.
I probably would have loved that game if we'd had it. But I mean, again, it's similar to sort of Mario Kart. Again, you know, when you're importing, we had Final Fight as an early game. So it just seemed like a luxury to have another brawler. Even though the multiplayer would have added a lot, I think, to the enjoyment.
I definitely think Turtles in Time is better than Final Fight. I also happen to think Final Fight's kind of shitty. But Turtles in Time is a very good brawler. I mean, it's like up there with like X-Men, the arcade game, or The Simpsons. It's probably a little bit better than those, actually. So I don't have any problems with it. It's just I'm not a big fan of brawlers, so I would never choose one.
It was one of the contentious games, I'll put it that way.
Yeah, I could see it being one of the fringe ones, and I'm actually really glad that some of the fringe games got in. I mean, ActRaiser was one that James and I fought for a lot, and
that game had to get in, or I would not be on the staff at this point. It was
yeah.
There were literal threats dropped about that game.
It is a gem. And for me, the reason that I pushed really hard for it, and I wrote the write-up for that, so that article is one I wrote, and the reason that I pushed so hard for ActRaiser is that is a game that I associate directly with Super Nintendo.
Yeah, there's nothing like it. I mean,
exactly. Yeah, it was an early game. Yeah, there was a lot of things that kind of laid down the marker for the period, like the graphics, you know, using the sprite scaling, rotation trickery with the title screen and the map and, you know, all that kind of stuff. But also the genre mixing, that, you know, this was kind of a new era. The possibilities were, you know, more open than they'd been in the past. So even though I didn't have it at the time. In fact, I've talked about on the show, the first time I played it was a cartridge copy in sort of pristine condition in 2008. So
nice. Ooh, yeah.
I didn't have that whole getting caught up in the moment of how important it was or how kind of shocking it was. But it still made my list because I enjoyed it a great deal playing it for the first time. It does hold up.
It's very
unique. It does. And I would say that the game's uniqueness is probably its best feature because it's not great at either of its two gameplay modes, which are this overworld monster hunting populace-ish mode, and then your standard Castlevania SNES style kill monsters in a dungeon mode.
But it was essentially the first of either of those kinds of games
on the system.
And the weird thing is that the two halves of the gameplay don't really interact with each other very much, and yet they feel both part of the same game. Like, they feel integral in some way.
Doesn't enhancing the towns increase your capabilities in the
action? Yeah, it increases your level. You get more health. You could use more.
Which you absolutely need in some of the later dungeons because they are they're walking through the street of Bakuba in an American flag hard.
No, I mean it definitely felt that way to me. Like, I was playing it in Japanese. And I don't like to go to a FAQ unless I have to. So I was just trying to feel my way through. Like, how are these interconnected? I wasn't really that sure. But once I got the hang of it, once I kind of realized the connection, I definitely started to think a lot more about the God mode. this is actually really important, you know, because it's going to make it a lot more doable.
It's not just unlocking the gate to get to the next dungeon.
Yeah, because that's the thing. I mean, you could regard it as padding or, you know, that sort of thing, maybe. But it really, the way that they're connected together, which, you know, isn't intricately, densely woven, but it's meaningful. And then they both hold up on their own merits. Maybe the action bit isn't as good as Castlevania IV. It's still good, you know, and I'm not well-versed enough to tell you how good of a god game it is, James.
It's not Populous, but it's good enough.
It's a lot more accessible than Populous, actually.
Populous is perfectly accessible.
It's not quite as in-depth.
I would actually say ActRaiser is my favorite god game. Not that it's a genre that I am into very deep, but I've played several of them, and it's my favorite of them.
I don't get what's even slightly inaccessible about Populous.
It's just Populous is very unguided. It's very unstructured. It's like, you know, make islands. It's like Doshin the Giant, basically. Like,
that game was on my list and it didn't get in, and I was very sad.
I mean, for me, the goal of Populous is like to make an earthquake and kill everybody, because there's no end point. There's no goal in mind. ActRaiser is very goal oriented. So yes, you're playing a god game, but you're a god with a mission, and it's a big deal.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, and, you know, one other thing I want to say about ActRaiser, I probably say this every time it comes up on the show, this game is $8 on Virtual Console. It's actually a very early Virtual Console release, and I think it's very largely been overlooked on Virtual Console the same way a lot of people overlooked it on Super Nintendo. You really should go play this game. There's nothing like it. There will probably never be another game that really captures it. Unfortunately, there don't seem to be any copycats of it. I wish there were. But it is a superb game, and as Greg has made very clear, it holds up extremely well.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So go spend your $8 and play ActRaiser. It's awesome.
We've discussed the sequel at length, and not even it's like this game.
Greg would like the sequel. I know you don't like it, James. I like it, but I'm just not good enough of a gamer to get everything out of it.
I would like to try it. I'm not convinced that I like it from what I've read about things. One thing in particular, apparently the soundtrack's a lot worse.
It is dreadful,
There's
actually
no particular reason I could discern for why it would be so much worse, but apparently it is. So, yeah, because that's no small thing in how good the original is. Is how wonderful the soundtrack is.
So one other game that I think it wouldn't have made my list, and I wondered if any of you guys had strong feelings about it, because I think it's kind of it's out of place a little bit on this list, is Kirby Superstar.
Yeah, I never played it.
Yeah, Kirby Superstar is one that I've played for the first time several years later. Didn't play it at the time. I talked about it when it came out on the Japan Virtual Console. I think it was the 500th game on Japan's Virtual Console. I just thought I'd mention that because it's quite far in the past, but somehow America hasn't got to 500 yet, and I enjoyed it. I'm not sure I enjoyed it enough to put it on this list the same way that I would have put Mega Man X on.
Right.
That was another one I hadn't played, but I feel strongly enough to have it. Just played it a few months ago. That gets on the list. Kirby, for me, it's not really my kind of game so much, you know, obviously very gentle, and the variety that there is very welcome compared to, you know, what I imagine maybe some other Kirby games might be like. And the soundtrack's great, and there's lots to like about it. I guess I just don't feel strongly enough that it would get on my list, but I could see why. You know, it is a lot of quality in that game.
See, I like that game much more than the Dreamland games, and I can't give you a reason why. I think it maybe I did buy into the 8 games in one thing. Like, it just felt funnier to me when you just walk into a door and who knows what kind of shit you're gonna have to deal with when you get in there. It fit with the weirdness of the series. It seems more closely related to Adventure for the NES than the Dreamland games.
Yeah, but see, I greatly prefer Kirby's Adventure to Kirby Superstar because it's an actual adventure. Like, it's a point-to-point game. I mean, yeah, there's a world map, like Mario World, sort of, but there are all these levels, and there's a consistency to them, whereas Superstar, I think the big problem for me is that, yeah, maybe, you know, there's 8 games in one, maybe half of them are really good, the other half are kind of throwaways, and the half that are good don't really add up to as much straightforward, good Kirby action as you get in Kirby Adventure, which is an NES game. And like, people talk about, what is the one mode that's kind of the biggest one? The
Great Cave Offensive, yeah.
Yeah, which is basically Subspace Emissary, which is shitty.
But it actually plays properly.
It's better than Subspace Emissary, but it's structured in a very similar way. It's just kind of this giant level with no indication of where to go, and it's just messy.
Actually, I like the Great Cave Offensive in part because, unlike Subspace Emissary, it's not totally fucked. I mean, there's hidden... It's what Subspace Emissary should have striven to be.
Well, that was clearly what they were going for with Subspace.
Yeah, absolutely. But... I mean, some of the problem, as I said, is Smash Brothers controls in that context just, you know, that's a problem. Because it constrains what you can design around it. I mean, the thing that I liked about the Great Cave Offensive is a lot of tight interior locations, which kind of limit, you know, Kirby's ability to just float over everything. You know, you're actually dealing with environments in a way, and therefore, you know, the powers can come into play a bit more. Because, like, well, if you actually have to deal with, like, enemies that are actually difficult to avoid, well, then being able to kill them in a convenient way because you have a power up is actually meaningful. So there's a lot of things about that I liked. Yeah, but the macro structure and all that is a bit sort of figgledy-piggledy, but it's some of the fun. It's just like, well, I'm just trying to collect as much treasure as I can, and you don't really know what exactly where everything is, but you just kind of plow on and do your best. It's a kind of a merry jaunt.
So when I played the Great Cave Offensive, I stumbled across one of the hidden treasures, and it was I think it was the Triforce. Like, that was the treasure that I found, and I went, oh shit, son, it just got real. And then I went on this hyper obsessive hunt to find all of these treasures. And anytime, I mean, most of the treasure was, you know, just treasure. But anytime you found something special, like things that were Nintendo character related, it made all the times you had looked and found something boring worth it. Because it was just like, what's the next thing they're going to hide in this game? Unfortunately, I never actually found all the treasures and got the max score, but that's probably better for me as a person. I think the max score actually stops 9 points short of the maximum display of the screen. But for me, these small, like, half games or quarter games, I kind of like it because I could play through Spring Breeze in a shot.
Yeah,
and I'm okay with that. You
it's
know,
like
I,
one level, right, or two levels, or something.
It's a few, I think, and then there's a boss battle.
It's basically as long as Kirby's Dream Land.
And then there's this very neat boss battle at the end of it. But there's some of the ones like the battle mode I find to be kind of amusing. And then there's a race, which is hilariously awesome.
So, John, you haven't had as much to say about the past couple games. Why don't you throw out something either on the list or we can start to go off of it?
Well, I mean, you know, obviously a huge one is Link to the Past. It's a huge, huge game. Final Fantasy III is certainly one of my favorite games ever.
Yeah, that'll probably come up again in a few weeks' time. So
yeah, that's the thing. I mean, the one game that sticks out on this list is Super Castlevania IV. One of my favorite games, really of all time, especially for its sound. I thought it had excellent sound for the time period.
Yep.
And it's interesting because I never actually played Castlevania III, so. You know, probably much like Super Mario 3 versus Super Mario World, I skipped the third and played the SNES version.
You're fine.
Yeah, well, that's the thing. Because, I mean, Castlevania 4 is a weird one relative to 3, because in some ways it's regressive, and then in other ways it's progressive. Because it takes away things like different characters, branching paths, or, you know, some of these things that the Castlevania 3 really opened up. But at the same time, with the way you handle the whip and all that, you know, the gameplay, the jumping is still pretty stodgy, but the gameplay is less restrictive because you can attack enemies from below, from above. You know, it does make handling enemies a lot easier in that way. So it would have been weird. I was in the same position. I did not play 3 before 4. So I'm not sure what that would have felt like. But I'm still confident that 4 would have held up on its own merits because of the, you know, particularly the presentation is very good. But there's plenty of things. If you are the kind of player that can accept some of the, as I said, the stodginess of classic Castlevania handling and the rules about holding up when you're jumping onto the stairs and all that kind of stuff, then you will enjoy Castlevania 4. I think the only thing that's weak about that game, unusual for a Konami Super Nintendo game in my view, is the bosses are kind of nothing to write home about. I mean, there's some that have some cool graphical techniques, but in general, it's not a big part of the game. But certainly, Contra 3 fixed that.
Mm-hmm. You think that's why the treasure guys split off after that? They were like, they won't let us do our crazy bosses, so let's go make our own company.
I think probably Castlevania may have suffered somewhat for being as early as it was. You know, they wanted to get it out. When you get to something like Contra 3, it showed that probably a bit more time kind of went into it with the just sheer cavalcade of craziness that ensues in that game.
I mean, it was a very early game, but I was really surprised at actually how good it was. Really, like, looking back, it's kind of funny. I think that people kind of, like, over the years have come to expect launch lineups to be pretty crappy. Just in general, they seem to, like, just as the years go by, they seem to kind of go downhill. But, I mean, that game was released very close to launch, and it was very, very good.
So, I was looking at the list from kind of an overall perspective, and, you know, and this is just the site list. This, again, my personal list would probably be even more tilted to this side, but I was sort of impressed that about half the games are third party. Yeah. And I don't think you could say that about a top 20 N64 games.
No way.
Or a top 20 GameCube games.
You'd hit 18 and be like, I'm out.
And probably not a top 20 Wii games.
No.
Maybe a little more balanced on the Wii side.
No. I don't know.
I think there's two elements to this. I mean, first of all, obviously the Super Nintendo was really the last time that you had this kind of robust third-party support for a Nintendo platform, especially on the Japan side. There was, you know, with sports games, all that, Genesis had a foothold in Western markets that certain Western developers might have focused on Genesis to some extent. But on the Japan side, you had Square, Enix, Capcom, Konami. They were all almost exclusively working on Super Nintendo. And, you know, that's why you had, especially at that time, you know, when development wasn't so established, in the console space in Europe or America, you know, that was where the best games were being made, was in Japan. And they were overwhelmingly being made for Super Nintendo. So you add that to Nintendo's own output and you have a formidable software library. But having said that, Nintendo as well were not nearly so prolific during this time as they have become since. You know, they didn't have as many development studios. I mean, here's an example. I pulled up a list of all the first-party published Super Nintendo games. So, for instance, 91, which is, of course, the year, you know, it was already out in Japan. You've just got SimCity, Kirby's Dream Course, A Link to the Past, and Super Tennis. That's it.
Hey,
yeah, that's...
Don't step on Super Tennis.
Super Tennis is excellent. I really love that game. But, you know, you are generally talking about, even, you know, deeper into its life, single digits in a year. It was not... the kind of, you know, these days with Wii, it's slowed down now, obviously, but we've seen years where Nintendo have put out many, many games, some that were developed internally, some that were, you know, they published, we have some like Sin and Punishment, you know, where they get treasure to do it or whatever. But Nintendo now is so, I guess they've had to do this. They've had practice.
Right.
You know, they've had to get used to supporting a console almost by themselves. And it was not really something they had to do in the Super Nintendo era. So it's only natural, really, that you would have so many third-party games on this list.
Well, yeah, I mean, in this time period, they had third-party on their side, or rather they were...
Well, no, they had third parties locked in their closet.
The fact that what happened next, where once they had a sort of viable out with PlayStation, you know...
There was a reason they were so willing to jump ship.
Yeah, well, they were the only game in town, really.
In Japan especially, as I believe we mentioned on the live show, you know, however much there was a battle going on in America... in Japan, the Super Nintendo was completely dominant.
Right, because Japan had the PC Engine, which was fairly successful, but...
If you liked shooters and fighters.
Well, right, I don't think NEC and Hudson really understood how to deal with third parties. I mean, it's pretty clear that they were trying to make a go of it, but they didn't really understand. And Sega was still pretty young at the time, and I think Sega was out of their league in Japan in terms of working with third-party developers. You know, they had a few things, but if you go back and look at the set, I mean, one reason there are so many Genesis games on Virtual Console is that Sega published almost all of them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Outside of EA, you know, people talk about EA, which was obviously a deal in America and maybe in Europe to some extent, not really a factor in Japan. In Japan, there wasn't really much third-party Genesis development to speak of. There were very few things. There's like Castlevania Bloodlines and Contra Hardcore. Yeah. But outside of that, a couple of examples, there's not much else
to
speak
of. Yeah, but
that's
pretty much it. Konami dipped their toes in the water. They also made, Rocket Knight Adventures, which is certainly, you know, there was the Genesis version, then there was a Super Nintendo version.
They're both awesome, yeah.
Yeah, I would. That's one on the list of Super Nintendo games I'd very much like to play that I still haven't. But Konami were kind of willing to experiment outside, but certainly, you know, their support for Super Nintendo remained very comprehensive.
I think Greg's right. The best companies did their best work on Super Nintendo during that era, and, you know, I don't know if we'll ever come back to that. I mean, again, Nintendo was obviously using some pretty heavy-handed tactics, and we're more in a more free-market game industry, you're never going to get that environment recreated. It's just not going to happen.
Publishers don't want that environment. They would not conspire because that would be illegal, but they would make business decisions driven by avoiding it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, the closest thing we've ever had to that is DS. I think we talked about when we did our 200th episode and we went in very in-depth with DS, I think this came up, but the DS library is probably the closest thing you'll ever get to Super Nintendo. And even then, I don't think the DS library is going to be...
It still doesn't compare.
You know, one of the games that I think was on my top 10 or whatever I submitted for this and didn't make the cut was Magical Quest starring Mickey Mouse, which we actually just have an extra life up for that. So we still got it covered, even though it's not in the 20 list. But Magical Quest is definitely one of my favorite Super Nintendo games, along with Aladdin, and, you know, a lot of people love. I think Lion King's a bit janky. There is an old... what was that thing Carl was doing?
Reset button.
Yeah. There is a fascinating episode on The Lion King that I would definitely recommend going back to listen to, but I don't think that game is that great. It's technologically impressive, perhaps, there's a ton of fans of Goof Troop, which I've never played. I've know nothing about it except it was Shinji Mikami's first game, and it's apparently kind of like Zelda.
What?
Yeah, it's like Link to the Past. Yeah.
That sounds like a meth-inspired hallucination.
I mean, all those Capcom games, they were all really, really good.
Seriously? Really? Shinji Mikami?
Yeah, Goof Troop.
Got to start somewhere.
Right, yeah. And apparently it's awesome. I would love to play it. It's a licensed game, so it's unlikely that I could ever get a re-release of it.
Yeah, there's a big sort of section of licensed games that people would not be able to rediscover. And that's the thing for me. Obviously, I loved the Super Nintendo at the time. Some of my favorite games come from that period, but I kind of got a limited slice, and I've, you know, stuff like Mega Man X, ActRaiser, you know, I've only come to enjoy those in the last few years, and you don't get to do that by and large with the licensed games, which is kind of sad, which, you know, maybe the reason why only TMNT manages it. For some of these other ones, maybe if people had been able to go back and play them, it might have had a bit more support.
God, Goof Troop, I'm not going to get over that tonight. Because that is not a good TV show. That was not good when I saw it as a child.
Yeah, I thought it was a really sappy, boring TV show, but apparently the video game is awesome.
I mean, for me, stuff that I had, you know, on my list that wouldn't have made it, we've said many times on the show in various contexts, Super Nintendo was not ideally constructed for shoot 'em ups, but there are still some good ones that I had on my list, predictably, that were probably never had much of a chance. So Axlay, I've spoken about many times.
That was on my list.
Konami developed, again, it's a lot of the guys that went on to form Treasure that mixes vertical and horizontal scrolling stages.
Yeah. And at the time, that got amazing reviews as well.
Yeah, for some reason, I've never played Axlay, and I would probably love it.
I think you would like it more than other shooters because it's less of the kind of, it's not bullet hell or it's not, ridiculous kind of speed or all that, because it tried to play to the Super Nintendo strengths, which it was a slower pace, more thoughtful shooter. And in many cases, I think it's better for it. It's very good.
Tons of Mode 7.
The vertical stages have a curvature to them. Yep. Using the Mode 7, that's quite nice. But then other than that, R-Type 3 is very, very good. Now,
Yes.
Super R-Type I had, and I enjoyed it, but it's a bit of a bollocked up version in many ways.
It's rife with slowdown.
The scrolling, though, even the basic scrolling is not smooth. It ticks along in discrete increments. It looks more like an MSX game than a Super Nintendo game in that regard.
Was it originally an MSX game by any chance?
No, that's Gradius that had the big MSX background, not R-Type. So a Super R-Type, it still has its merits, including a very good soundtrack, but it seems like it was a mismatch for the game and the hardware. R-Type 3 comes along a bit later, and it, I think, is a vast improvement. Very, very difficult, like most R-Type games, of course, but a really great exclusive Super Nintendo shooter again. And then to complete the shooter lot of my ones that didn't make it, UN Squadron. Really, really good.
Yes. You still haven't said the one I thought you were going to say in the first place. Finish UN Squadron.
Well, UN Squadron, amazing. I like the fact that it's got these elements of upgrading your aircraft and all that kind of stuff, but it's also just a really good shooter. It's got very memorable levels, in the clouds, going through caves, a complete rip-off of the R-Type battleship at the end. But it's just really, really good. And nice break from the whole space thing. At the time, that felt like a nice, to have something that was explicitly military, felt a bit more real. Despite the sort of anime pilots, it was pretty cool.
Yes. I actually talked about UN Squadron on a episode of Radio Trivia, where I picked this. This was my personal game of choice because its music is kind of amazing.
Good Capcom music, definitely.
I love UN Squadron. I always loved it in the arcade. I never got to play the Super Nintendo version very much, but I did love that game.
I haven't played it, period, so I've only seen it in the arcade.
Again, see, that's got a relation to some sort of license, hasn't it? In Japan, it was Area 88, and that's something.
Yeah, it's some anime that I don't know anything
about. It's a shame, again, because this is good stuff.
Yeah. Well, so the shoot 'em up that I thought you were going to show, that you're going to pull out, Greg, is Gradius 3, which
I love Gradius 3, but it's just, it's not as good as those other games.
Maybe not. It's the one I played the most.
The thing is about Gradius 3, for a lot of people, it's probably like the definitive Super Nintendo shoot 'em up because it was early on in the system.
It was one of my first games, yep.
And obviously, you've talked about how great the soundtrack is and all that, but like Super R-Type, it's not a good match because it is...
Right. Oh, it's a mess.
There are changes, but, it's an early game where you're trying to downport from the arcade. It's a bit of a problem. The games that came later that were more tailored to the Super Nintendo, I think, do the genre much more justice on the platform. The sad thing is that they never did another Gradius game on the Super Nintendo.
Right.
Nope.
Yeah, and I never, that was really the first one I'd played. I mean, I'd played a little bit of the original Gradius and didn't like it that much. I'd played very little of Life Force until Virtual Console, long time later. And Gradius 4, is that even a thing? Is that Gradius Gaiden?
Yeah, no, Gaiden is not 4, but I think 4 didn't come out, at least in Europe, until they did the PlayStation 2 launch game, Gradius 3 and 4.
Yeah, I know nothing about Gradius.
I think Gradius 4 is a relatively obscure entry in the series.
Okay, because Gradius 5 is fucking awesome. That's a treasure shoot 'em up for PS2, and holy crap, it is fantastic.
It's badass.
You have all these different weapons you can choose from, and I just think it's super awesome. And Gradius 3 is really the same way in that you have all these different weapon sets. And again, yeah, this is on Virtual Console, and take Greg's point to heart. It does not run well on Super Nintendo, which means it's not going to run well on Virtual Console. But at the same time, it makes it kind of easy. So if you really suck at shoot-ups,
it does help, yep.
Yeah, and also there's the code that you can use once per level that maxes you out and gives you all the weapons and stuff. And it is a very easy shoot-em-up if you know what to do. And right, and it's still graphically impressive, and it's just extremely inventive with all the monster designs and the bosses. And
it's just a cool game.
It's awesome, yeah.
Mm-hmm. It's, I mean, the fact that it didn't quite make my list is, don't let that dissuade you from the game. It's, if you're a shooter fan,
you're good to go.
It's still well worth checking out. Although there's other ways to play it now, obviously, like you could play the arcade version, sort of on like the collection for PSP or, you know, various other avenues. But the one I think the Super Nintendo soundtrack is actually better than the arcade, so there is that. Hmm.
Come get you some, as it were. Some Gradius.
James, I know a game that you and I share a great mutual affection for that did not make the list, unfortunately. It's one of several RPGs, that somewhat more obscure RPGs, that I love.
I have two that I was very upset about.
So let's start with Breath of Fire 2.
Yes.
Extol the virtues, my man.
Another Capcom game. It's amazing. How about that? How about that for a virtue?
Yeah. So this series is interesting because the original Breath of Fire was Capcom saying, hey, we have a lot of success on Super Nintendo. We have all these different franchises in several different genres that are really working for us. But the one thing we don't have is an RPG.
And more importantly, we don't have an RPG series.
That's right. We don't have an RPG series. So why don't we pay Square, the experts, to make an RPG for us, which apparently, given Super Mario RPG also, apparently this is something Square was available for. They were kind of like the contract RPG dudes at the time. They were obviously making their own stuff that was popular, but they were also available to make RPGs for other publishers. And so Capcom paid Square to make Breath of Fire, and it was good, but not amazing or anything. It was a little bit generic. It had a couple of cool ideas.
The implementation of a dragon, the fact that you are a fucking dragon, was kind of cool.
That was like the best thing about it. Then Capcom says, okay, now you've started the franchise for us, you kicked it off, we're going to take over, so get out of our way, and we're going to make this series internally from here on. And they made Breath of Fire 2 in-house, and it's much better than the first Breath of Fire.
It is awesome.
Yeah.
I'm trying to remember when I played that game initially. It was a very, very long time ago, and I seem to recall that the first thing that struck me about it was that the story actually kind of felt sad, mm-hmm. like at the very start. Like, it starts out like, yeah, shit's got real in this city, son.
It's like you wake up in your hometown and no one knows who you are. There's some really strange stuff that I see. I never could beat this game. You get to a certain point, it becomes really, really difficult and also not very clear where you should go next. And I've gotten to that point like on three different playthroughs, I think. So I've never seen how the story actually resolves. And it's a very strange, mysterious story. So maybe offline you can explain it to me sometime. But
let me put it this way. It's got a rather tragic start, a rather tragic middle, and a rather tragic end. But what people might not realize about the Breath of Fire series is that there's six of them, although one was called Dragon Quarter.
That was five. That was the last one. There's no
six. Was it five? Okay, there's five then.
Unfortunately, I hope it comes back one day. Although, we should mention Breath of Fire 4 just came out on PlayStation Network. You can get it for like $6.
They all have, well, I guess manifestations of the same hero.
Mm-hmm. His name's Ryu.
But they all, at least the ones I've played, seem to have really bad luck. And like really tragic luck at the end. So it's kind of like, wow, this is kind of fucking depressing. But for like a 10-year-old, that was really depressing shit.
Yeah. Well, there's also just a lot of weird stuff. I mean, maybe this will help explain why James loves Breath of Fire 2 so much. There is a place in the game where you walk into a restaurant and they make you take all your clothes off and go into a special room where they proceed to attempt to cook you alive so that they can serve you to their customers.
Yes.
Did I describe that accurately?
That seems reasonable enough.
Yeah.
Based on my recollection of the event. What I found was just, though, that the world it took place in was unusually well-developed for an RPG of its era. Mm-hmm. There were a lot of different types of races in there. There was a lot of backstory. If you played previous games in the series, the backstory started to kind of layer on top of itself. It felt like a well-constructed world, and the gameplay felt tight enough, and the battle system had enough little quirks in it that you could use. You know, there was just enough stuff that seemed right that this game, to me, felt better than some of Square's other works on the platform.
It just
felt like a much tighter game for me. I mean, I actually like the original Breath of Fire, but 2 trounces it.
Yeah, and I would also say 2 is better than Breath of Fire 3, which I remember vaguely. I mean, I played it, I rented it on PlayStation, played a lot of it, but I still think 2 is the best in the series that I've played. And it's really long, and it has a big, big world for you to explore. There's a lot of crazy stuff, a lot of optional side quests and things like that that you can really get lost in. And it's super impressive. And it is available on Game Boy Advance. So it's fairly...
Yes, it is.
I don't think it's on Virtual Console.
2?
Is it?
2 is on the VC.
Yeah, I remember it being talked
there
about.
This is a game that I think most people have not played. And they really should. It's if you're into 16-bit RPGs, you really need to check out Breath of Fire 2. It is very impressively made.
Yep, I'm probably going to buy it now thanks to this conversation.
Yeah.
God damn it.
Like, I need more games on my backlog.
God damn it.
Yeah, I mean, if you're interested in getting off the beaten path of Final Fantasy and, you know, Mario RPG.
Well, I'm about to take us a little bit deeper off the beaten path.
Oh,
so
snap.
Put on your explorer's helmet, gentlemen, because we're going to Lufia 2.
Ooh.
Which is so much better than Lufia, the original game.
Oh, yeah.
It is. It's painfully better. But Lufia 2, for me, might be my favorite RPG on that system.
Wow.
Wow.
It's just such a... I'm trying to really explain why I like this game so much. It goes back to this kind of world where they've created this setting that they can build in, and they build the story around a world versus just building this kind of generic story and then putting a world on top of it. There's so much going on in the game. It's an interesting combat system. There's lots of things that you can do, like you can equip these rings to gain certain customizing skills to get through towers and dungeons and stuff. There's monsters that will show up once in a world, and you can gain these members of your party that will fight with you. I mean, there's just so much stuff in that game that I really enjoyed just exploring all the depths of it, including this weird, like, sub-quest thing that's kind of roguelike-ish, but not nearly as terrible. I mean, it is a deep fucking game.
Regretfully, I never got very far into it, because it's one of those RPGs with a lot of puzzles in the dungeons.
Yes.
A bit like Zelda or Brain Lord, but it's an RPG. It's not like an action-adventure game like those.
And to me, those puzzles were part of the charm of the game.
Yeah. Actually, if you play Tales of Symphonia, it's a little bit like
that. It is very much like the Tales series, although I would say the puzzles are generally a little bit more complicated than most Tales puzzles.
Yeah, because there was a dungeon I was enjoying the game a lot, and I feel like not very far into it, I got to some puzzle that I just could not for the life of me figure out. And this was back in the days of, you know, you might have Nintendo Power, you know, map or something. And I couldn't find any help for it. I don't think I had the internet at the time, and I could not get past it. And I was really upset about it because I wanted to play more of the game, and I just couldn't proceed.
Yeah, that's what the 1-900 number's for.
I only ever did that to ask how to find Shala in Chrono Trigger, and the poor guy said you can't, and I was truly heartbroken. But
if only it'd been years later and they'd said, have you looked in Tokyo or wherever the fuck that thing is in the Chrono Cross?
I desperately need to play Lufia 2 again, because I feel like I truly missed out.
It's kind of sad that they got to do this remake, but not, you know, they cleaned it up enough, the rights, to do a remake, but not to put it out on Virtual Console. That's weird, isn't it?
So, I mean,
a shitty remake, too, apparently.
There's good reviews for that game, but they change it to, you know, the way you said, it's an RPG, but it's got puzzles.
so it's not an action adventure? Well, they did change it to an action adventure.
So when I played it at E3 2010, I was horrified by what I played. Hmm. I mean, it was not the game that I remember.
Right, and I want to play the one you remember, because I have very, very vague memories of that were equally positive, just brief, because I didn't see as much of the game. So just to move on, a game that I felt very passionately about and really lobbied to get onto the list, and it didn't make it, is one of my personal all-time favorites, Illusion of Gaia.
Mm.
Have any of you played this?
I've never played it.
Or part of it.
No, I have not played it.
So, James, I want your input on this. It's a game that's a little bit difficult for me to describe to people because it is unique. Unless you've played Soul Blazer or Terranigma, there's not much else quite like it.
I mean, I'm not showing me much help. It was 15 years ago, and I only played it for a little bit, so.
Okay. Well, I've played the entire game multiple times because I'm a huge fan of it. It is a bit like A Link to the Past, except set in our world, our real world. Except a very strange version of it in which the only places you ever see are basically ancient ruins. So you play this character. It's a fantasy game, but it's set on Earth, and you travel the world visiting all these ancient ruins. So you go to the Great Wall of China, and you go to Angkor Wat. So you go to all these weird places. You go to the pyramids of Giza, and you go to these places, and you explore them as if they were Zelda dungeons. And they're really well-designed Zelda dungeons. They're full of crazy puzzles, and they ask you to do... And I remember that the game really makes you think outside the box on how to solve the puzzles. And it's true, in the very first puzzle of the game, you have this flute that you can sort of spin, and it makes weird things happen when you spin it. And you think, oh, okay, I'm going to use this to solve all these puzzles. And there's this one room you go into, and the only way to solve it, and there's a clue that sort of leads you in this path, but it's such a weird solution that you can very easily look over it. I think there's a certain tile that's like glowing, and all you have to do is stand on it for like 10 seconds. You just have to be patient. And the game leads you right up to that point, but it's such a weird solution to the puzzle that you're almost reticent to actually take it, to actually try that, you know?
Yeah, patience is not something that games at that point were designed to breed.
Exactly. And it was really shocking when I played that, and it really prepares you for the whole game. It has this weird approach to things, and the story is truly fascinating. I mean, the story is completely unforgettable. If you ever play Illusion of Gaia and you get into the meat of the story, you will remember it, because it does such weird things that no video game up to that point, and even today, really, games don't deal with things like this. I mean, at some point you visit a town, a bustling city that is very lavish up front. There's all these amazing shops, and there's a place where if you merely stand in line, they will give you free items that are very, very useful, like heart containers, basically. And all you have to do is stand in line. They're just giving them out for free. And you're like, wow, this city is amazing. And then if you keep going up and up and up back into the depths of the city, you find out that there's an entire lower class there of slaves who are the reason that the city is so vibrant and successful on the front end. And you proceed to make friends with some of the slaves and lead a rebellion and free them. And this is in like 1994.
Yeah, you know? And not
it's
only that.
It's amazing stuff.
Nintendo published this game outside of Japan.
Really? I didn't know that. I mean, it was made by Enix, by Quintet.
They took this, by Quintet, and Enix published it in Japan, and Nintendo did it everywhere else.
Wow.
They took the shit on.
It's an incredible game story. I mean, there is a scene later on where you become stranded on a raft with only you, and it's your main character and the girl, who up to that point has been fairly annoying, quite frankly, in the storyline, and she's annoying on the raft at first. But you're on this raft, and it's essentially a story scene that's stretched out to about 20 minutes of you just, because you can't go anywhere. You're on the raft in the middle of the ocean. You're shipwrecked, and you're floating along, and there's nothing for you to do except talk to this girl. And so it forces the characters, within the context of the story, it forces them to fall in love. So by the time you get off this raft, your emotional relationship to this other character is completely different than when you got on it. And by the way, in the process, you're starving and you have to cook her pet pig, who has a name. His name is Hamlet.
Oh, that's right. I remember hearing about that part.
He's a very endearing character in the story up to that point.
Yes.
And because the situation is so dire, he essentially offers himself up. He throws himself onto a fire,
yes,
and sacrifices himself so that you don't starve to death. And in a sense, it's cartoonish. And in another sense, it is incredibly poignant and tragic on a level that I had never seen in a video game. And in the context of the story, it's truly heartbreaking. I mean, this game is amazing. It just does things that no other game does. And I would say, again, it's not licensed or anything. I don't understand why Illusion of Gaia hasn't been re-released in some form, because it's a game that people need to play.
Yeah, I mean, why? There's no reason for it to not be on the Virtual Console. It's not like NX properties aren't available.
And it sounds like Nintendo might even still hold the publishing rights. So I truly don't understand why this game is hard to find now. It is a game that people need to play.
Also, it has, just as an aside, when we were doing developing one of the live radio trivia shows, this game came up, and the music in it is stunning.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah, just stunning. And the guy who made the music for it only made two other game soundtracks, and they're all fucking weird. One's a Mahjong, one's Mahjong, and one's called Super Okuman Chozo Game, The Game of Billionaires.
Wow.
And if you go watch a YouTube video game of that, someone playing that, your mind will implode.
So, truly unique, amazing storyline, fantastic soundtrack, and it looks gorgeous, amazing artwork and animation. And I started this conversation out by saying that it plays like Zelda: A Link to the Past. Why is this game not famous? Why don't people talk about Illusion of Gaia more? I don't understand.
Yeah, I mean, I think it should be re-released just to get word out.
Yeah. If you haven't already started writing down cartridges to look for on eBay, this is one to add to the list, really.
Yeah, that's the thing, though. I mean, I've got a lot of stuff for the Japanese Virtual Console. Super Nintendo games easily outnumber everything else, every other format, even with my poncho for shooters, actually meaning that I have TG16 games and Genesis games, which some people probably wouldn't. But yeah, still, Super Nintendo rules the roost on my Japanese Wii. But there's still so many games that I haven't played. You know, I mean, definitely some of those other Quintet games. Demon's Crest, we talk about a great deal.
Oh.
The fourth Goemon game, which is not on Virtual Console. Like, 2 and 3 I have. I think they're excellent. I would have a spot on the 20 list for either one of those.
I'd love to play those.
They're quite
There
different.
Should be a collection, right? Konami should just translate all of them and make a collection. And
It would be nice if they did that. Although the way things are these days, they'd probably bring it out for PSP if they did it at all. But,
yeah. Okay, fine. I mean, that'll just push me even harder to, you know.
But the fact is, Super Nintendo does have a deep library, which, you know, as we've often complained about, the Virtual Console still hasn't tapped all the way down into, you know, there's still so... There's the obvious stuff like Yoshi's Island, Star Fox, which are on the list, but Illusion of Gaia and all that kind of stuff is a great example.
All right, now, if you look at our list, the one thing that's missing is sports games.
So yeah. I actually had one I wanted to mention.
I actually have a couple that I want to mention. The first one is Tecmo Super Bowl, which was a sequel to Tecmo Super Bowl on the NES, a kind of a semi-sequel. Why they have the same name, looking back, I really don't know.
I didn't even know that.
No, it's not. No, the NES one is just Tecmo Bowl.
There's two of them. No, there's Tecmo Bowl and Tecmo Super Bowl on the NES.
I trust John on this one.
And then there's also Tecmo Super Bowl on the Super NES. They're different games, but same name.
John is the biggest Tecmo Bowl fan I know. I trust him
completely on this. That's a high list.
So, I mean, what it did is it took the NES Tecmo Super Bowl and it, you know, kind of, you know, obviously gave it a little bit of a overhaul graphically. Probably, you know, tweaked a bit more. I have not played that game for ages, but I just remember that, you know, it was completely, I mean, the NES game was great. Obviously, a huge thing was, you know, they updated the rosters for, I think it would have been 92, 93, I think. And people still play leagues in that to this day. It's one of those games
Wow.
that will never, ever die. Very much like the NHL 94, 95 games for Sega.
So you named one sports game for Super Nintendo. Can you name two?
The other one...
Because there weren't that many good ones.
Well, the other one is very niche, It's by a company that you guys may recall, Culture Brain, and it is Super Baseball Simulator 1.000.
I was I was about to say that.
That's where I was about to go.
And
it is
my favorite baseball game ever because
it's so good.
You only have a 12-team league. But you can edit every single player and every single team on it. So you can
You have attribute points that you distribute to different stats.
But the best thing is it is completely over the top.
Well no, it's totally straight-laced baseball if you play in the East and West leagues.
True.
But it's when you go into the Ultra League that shit gets real.
Yeah, shit is crazy. But the home runs in that game, when you hit a home run out of the park, you really feel like you killed it. Because the greatest thing about it is the mechanic that they use is literally where you hit the ball, where the ball, you know, obviously you have to have somebody who's like really, really pumped up, you know, so you can, you know, you can pump your players up.
Juicing. Yeah.
But literally like how you time it and where, if the ball hits the fat part of your bat and you time it just right and you can get it down every time, you can just crush the ball every time. And I mean, when you crush the ball, it goes out of the stadium.
But there's also all the superpowers.
Well, that's if you're playing in the Ultra League, which is when those shit gets nuts. So
yeah, that's what I loved about it. You've got all the crazy pitches, the ones that disappear and dance all over the place.
Yep.
And they go super, super slow.
So pitchers in the Ultra League have a handful of special pitches they can throw that do things like shoot out like a cannon or explode when the batter hits them.
Mm-hmm.
It's technically a ball, or like weave around in crazy patterns that make them very hard to hit, or slow way the hell down.
Yep.
So the batter swings too early, and then the batters have powers to sort of counter them. Like one of them is kind of like the first off, the game is a Japanese game that got Americanized a bit.
Mm-hmm.
So one of them is the ball turns into a leaf and drifts to the ground when somebody tries to catch it.
Yep. I love that one.
One of them is a rocket where if anybody actually catches it, they get shot all the way across the stadium into the wall by the ball.
Yep.
And then just fall to the ground in a heap.
Yeah, with the little stars going around their head.
Yeah. One is if somebody catches it, it explodes and he's knocked out.
Yep.
And one of them is it goes way into the air and you see the shadow on the ground start to get big. First off, the shadow is gigantic.
Uh-huh.
And it gets smaller and smaller and smaller. And then it just goes, smashes straight into the ground, which is amazing. God, that game.
That's by far the baseball game that I've played the most of in my life.
It's amazing. It's such an amazing game.
I have played many, many complete seasons in that game.
You know why I think I was into this game? I think this came out around the same time as that movie where the kid from American Pie, when he was younger, he does something to his arm and he gains the magical ability to throw baseballs at like 120 miles an hour, so mm-hmm. he gets in the major leagues even though he's like 14.
Yes.
I can't remember the name of it, but I think that came out around the same time, and that was probably the peak of my interest in baseball, and it went way downhill after that. But it was the magical element, the idea that someone could be like superhuman at baseball that I found actually somewhat interesting.
I mean, as somebody who loves baseball, and I mean, part of the reason I picked this apartment is there's a baseball stadium across the freaking road. But I just loved that game just as a pure baseball game. Because
mm-hmm.
as a baseball game, I mean, granted it was juiced up beyond all belief, but like you could play, if you weren't playing in the Ultra Leagues, you could play like National League ball strategy. You know,
yeah, it
like,
has simulator in the title.
Like you had to understand when to bunt, when to lead off bases, when to steal. Because if you were playing against somebody who did, he was going to basically rock you.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. And you were going to lose like 47-6. That was why it was so good though to play it with somebody else. Because watching each other's teams play while you're just sitting there just stoking the fire.
Yep.
When it was finally time to throw down, every little, like, the game was just hinged life and death on every stolen base, every bunt, every attempt to use a superpower that ended terribly wrong. I mean, it was
yeah,
like
wasted superpowers is the worst.
Yeah.
No matter what happened, somebody was going to be on the highest of highs, and somebody was going to be utterly dejected.
That's what sports is all about.
And that was going to change in the next minute 18 more times.
All right. Well, there you go. If you always thought Super Nintendo didn't have any good sports games, we just proved you wrong. So that's going to have to wrap it up, guys. I feel like we could probably just keep going for another couple of hours, but this show's long enough already. So we're going to call it quits, people. Maybe we'll come back and talk about Super Nintendo on the European anniversary. Maybe we'll do it again. We'll make it a trifecta.
Roughly about a year from now. Yeah,
you can tell us all about Terranigma.
Well, I pretty much the only thing I can think of where Europeans land is in the sports category, International Superstar Soccer.
Hey, that would be great.
Konami, mm-hmm. You know, basically that was the beginning of what's become the Pro Evo franchise.
Oh, I didn't realize its lineage was that far back.
Yeah, that's right. That's where it started. It was like ISS and ISS Deluxe. They were really good exclusive Super Nintendo football games.
All right, well, that is going to wrap up our Super Nintendo discussion. I hope you enjoyed it. We certainly got pretty in-depth on a few of these games, and, you know, that's the fun part. That's what it's all about. So even if you haven't played them, I hope you caught some of the excitement, some of the enthusiasm that we have for this era. It is certainly worth revisiting, and some of these games are not easy to find, but totally worth tracking down and playing for yourself one way or another. And, you know, one way or another, we're going to talk about Killer 7 next week. I don't know if it's going to be the only time we talk about it or if we're going to split it up. I haven't started playing it yet. That's my big weekend project. So we'll call an audible. And either way, we will do retroactive next week on Killer 7, which means Carl will be here. I will drag his ass onto the podcast to defend Killer 7, to explain to us why he loves it and why it's apparently awesome. And we'll also be reading off your forum posts from the thread. So if you haven't dropped your thoughts in there, if you're playing along, or if you've ever played Killer 7, or if you just have questions about it, maybe you can drop those into the retroactive forum thread. Just go to NintendoWorldReport.com, forums, podcast discussion. You'll see it right there at the top. We'll also have a link in the show notes, so you can also just click on the article for this very episode of the podcast, and there will be a link in there as well. You can read up what everyone else is saying and join the conversation, and we'll pull out some of your comments and read them on the show next week. Finally, a couple more upkeep things. The email address for this show is rfn@nintendoworldreport.com, and I don't know if we'll have time for email next week. It sort of depends on how much we talk about Killer 7, but we will continue to collect and read your emails, and we will get another email segment on the show as soon as possible, for sure. And a little very quick update on the RFN t-shirts. I have made a little bit of progress since the 250 episode, the live show. I brought it up because someone asked about it. I am still working on it. I have identified a possible printer and vendor for this, and I'm working on the artwork. I have some help from the staff. So things are progressing. It's not going as quickly as I wanted it to, but we are moving forward, and damn it, I'm going to make this happen. Because I want to wear an RFN t-shirt, and I think some of you do as well. So I hope you will be willing to pay for the privilege.
Well, some people are entitled to them.
Yes, all right. That's the end of the show. Thank you, everyone, for listening. We'll see you next week. Thank you.
Well, the way it is with MMOs, it's like they will ship it in any state they can ship it in and then just patch it afterwards.
Yeah, it worked real well for Final Fantasy 14.
Yeah, I was about to bring that up. Like, is that game playable yet?
They would literally kill that game if they could get away with it and save face.
That's the whole thing. They're kind of backed into a corner because they're at the point now where they have to, I think they kind of have to keep it going long term just to break even on it at some point.
Well, and James has a great point. They did call it Final Fantasy 14.
Yeah.
So they can't just write it off.
Exactly.
No. Like they really, like, if they want to make a Final Fantasy 15, it might behoove them to make 14 somewhat respectable.
Yeah, it's a mess.
They really aren't talking about it anymore.
Well, that's the wild card, though. They could just literally call the next game Final Fantasy 14.
Yeah.
Let's just we'll just take a do-over, you know, just mulligan on this one, guys.
Yeah. And if anybody asks, just deny.